amount of frustration in trying to get me to do things even close to on time that you guys have gone through. I have a question before I begin asking about this, because I'm afraid I wasn't here yesterday. I was driving somewhere to West Virginia at that point trying to get here. About the Buffett thing. In the talk and discussion about the Buffett stuff, did Buster Keaton's name come up or not?
It did not.
It did? Really? Wow. Okay. Well, I mean, you know that locomotive chase thing out there, the great locomotive chase, which gets turned into a Disney movie around 1962, I think. But of course, it's also the inspiration for Buster Keaton's The General. I mean, it's those raiders, Buffett and his people, that grab the locomotive called The General, and Buster Keaton has to go back and try to get his beloved, you know, piece of machinery back. It's sort of one of the great silent movies out there. If you've never seen. How many people here have seen The General? Any of you? Isn't it cool? Isn't it wonderful? Okay, well, I just wanted to bring that up. You know, it just suddenly struck me, and I went, hey, I'm on familiar turf here. Well, all right, let me see what I can talk about here. I mean, my account, that should be pretty clear in terms of guerrilla movement, has nothing whatsoever to do with anything that I actually research or write about, except in a very peripheral way. But I kept finding things, and maybe they add to a larger message. And the larger message really is that Civil War history is, well, you guys figured this out yesterday and today, Civil War history is too tidy. There's not a question about it. I mean, the panelists, you know, have made it very plain, and so plain that, you know, even a military historian can see it out there, that, you know, amid all the comforting logic of battles and campaigns where brigades move in lines and the first and I Corps wings wide and all that kind of stuff, and things you can set down on a map. If we look closely and if we look at the governor's papers, what we see is a society behind the lines that's cracking or breaking apart, both on the Union side in the border states, certainly, and in the Confederacy, and I would bet in large parts of the Union, but nobody's looked there yet, so they don't know. What have we found when we look at these papers? We find outlaws with a taste for women's clothing. We find African Americans tipping over the established hierarchies by tippling. We find runaways and reports of poisons. We find household larder stripped bare by the so-called protectors of the Southern home and the alleged preservers of the American homeland and so on. And all the rules that where the black person knew his or her place and the Irish immigrant knew his are changed in a war where patriotism and emancipation make remissions and exemptions and exceptions and routes of escape or opportunity, even for prostitutes, as we've talked about this morning. It really is that theme, is the war as a breeder of chaos, it seems to me, that we just keep coming back to here. And how hard it was for the scratch of a pen on terms of surrender on a table in a parlor in Appomattox to restore order again, especially to those suffering from the emotional trauma of wartime. And it's there, really, that the real story, I think, of guerrilla warfare in Kentucky may really fit in. Now, guerrilla warfare, for those of you who are Civil War buffs, as I'm sure a lot of you are, and has been much more thoroughly studied than ever in the last 20 years. There's books about Missouri, about partisan warfare in eastern Tennessee. There's a lot of stuff out there, but Kentucky remains really relatively neglected in that respect. It really is rather thin on the dark and bloody ground there, it should be said. And the disorder that regulators brought, or irregulars brought, is something that really needs a much closer look than historians have actually given it so far. And I think part of the fault really belongs to, the kind of people that really, really enjoy reading about and talking about the Civil War, and the kind of people that put up statues in downtown Lexington. What we've got, we've got a statue of John Hunt Morgan on Wrong Gender Horse. We got a statue of John C. Breckinridge, which is a testimonial to the immortality you can have if you really really, really are assiduous and diligent at being mediocre. I mean, it's a striking thing, but the enraptured quality that goes with the romance of John Hunt Morgan and so on, or that alleged, supposed gorilla in women's clothing, the so-called Sue Monday, Jerome Clark out there, I mean, you know, may place a shape or a logic on the Kentucky experience that really pulls it out of its true form and its true shape. And I think a number of sort of the basic sources on that really go. I can think of two, really, that really concerned me a bit this way. One's an article that came out around 1988, and it talks about the different forms that irregular warfare takes. People that really are licensed by the Confederate government, and then there are small bands that can't get connected together with the John Hunt Morgans and people like that, and they're working on their own to burn railroad tracks and do all kinds of, you know, exciting and dashing things. And the author talks about these for about 20 pages, and then he says, and then of course there were bandits. Let's move on right now and talk about all the other people. I'm not interested in the bandits. I'm not going to put down any footnotes on it. And then I go way back to the, was it 1923, Civil War and Readjustment in Kentucky, E. Merton Coulter. And E. Merton Coulter will talk about guerrilla warfare, and he'll talk about bandits and say, well, of course there was band creed and outlawry there, and this was a terrible thing, and everybody thought it was bad, and it's everybody's fault on both sides. But what I really want to talk about and give you details about is the awful, awful, awful things that the Union Army did to try to suppress these kind of things. And let me give you detail on that. And that's exactly what he does. And I think this is nuts. I think in terms of the actual newspaper record, this really gums up the works out there, because the plain and simple fact is so-called irregular warfare was, well, in Kentucky, if you look at the newspapers, it was local all over. And it got worse as the war went on, and the further away Confederate victory came, seemed to be, and the closer Confederate defeat came, the worse it got out there. Now, one correspondent with the governor, in fact, would boast that he came from the only county that hadn't been afflicted by the guerrillas. And frankly, I think it's probably right about that. I think probably, looking at the newspaper reports and the rest, I think every county really seems to have had some of these kind of disorders and the like. And by concentrating on those people most closely connected to the Confederate military system, the John Hunt Morgans, for example, and acting in semi-official capacities, maybe having Confederate commissions and so on, we really may miss what guerrillas typically did and who their victims actually were. And it's when we do that we discover that the typical reader seems to have a lot less in common with John Hunt Morgan than he has with Jesse James, or Quantrill, or for that matter, Johnny Depp in Pirates of the Caribbean, I'm sorry to say. I mean, we're talking about horse theft. We're talking about cold-blooded murder of unarmed human beings. We're talking of unarmed men being taken out of their houses and having their faces pounded in with musket butts before getting stripped and shot to death. I mean, it's incidents that feel less like war and more like the Klan in the South than their night riding. I mean, robbing banks, holy, you gotta see that. Whoa, against the United States government, but stealing watches from every piece. Exactly how does that help the Confederate war effort when you're not really asking the person which side they're on before you decide that their watch has now been commandeered for your purposes? I mean, warfare behind the lines, can help those at the front. I don't deny that. But in Kentucky, the violence and the savagery seemed to peak after the last viable force that could have been helped had dissolved completely. And as the Confederate collapse just seemed a matter of weeks away, the question wasn't if, the question was when, in January and February of 1865, when this kind of thing could happen out there. And banditry and more authorized guerrillas may have been distinguished from each other, and some historians try to do it, but the evidence just doesn't draw any lines at all. It really doesn't. The same people who are out there and firing on railroad cars, hauling war materials, are also the ones that are ransacking private homes and stores and kidnapping civilians under the guise of conscripting them for the Confederacy, never intending to do that, knowing that by carrying away from their homes, they will pay ransom, which is exactly what they do. What we notice, in other words, very clearly, is that the violence persists, and it even lasts well after the war is over. And as a matter of fact, it may have lingered for years, a kind of a lawlessness that authorities could only partly suppress. And we're not just talking Kentucky here. We're talking Missouri. We're talking Tennessee. We're talking Arkansas, Mississippi, Alabama. It's out there. It's everywhere out there. Well, is there a larger takeaway from studying this kind of stuff? Well, I think there may be several. There's one. Let's start out with the first. The experience of Kentucky, it seems to me, shows plainly why the road to victory that some scholars in the 1970s and 80s posited, why didn't they just take to the woods and the hills? Why didn't they, instead of doing arms in the open field where the Confederacy couldn't win, why didn't they engage in guerrilla warfare? Hey, it worked in Vietnam for them guys out there in the black pajamas. I mean, this is something that ultimately the Union would have given up on and so on. But this road to victory, this alleged road to victory, was really no road at all. Now, other historians have told you why. You do this and slave is gone. I mean, you have an irregular war out there and every slave is going to leave the plantation. They're going to be gone. Or it's going to be like a license for slave uprising. And that's true. Other people say, you create a war like this and the elites, the toffs, the guys at the top, the Theresa Mays of Southern politics will suddenly no longer have control of the situation anymore. And in fact, it will be in the hands of the rabble, the hoi polloi, the deplorables in Southern society down there. But, I don't think that's really the reason. Anybody that's been around in an age of guerrilla warfare, if they've seen what it looks like on reality on the ground, they know that essentially guerrilla warfare simply means anarchy and chaos. And it's something that no army, no soldiers out there, no commander can possibly control. Because every privateer basically becomes a pirate. They go after everybody, and every citizen or non-citizen becomes a potential victim of those who brandish a license to kill and to rob and to wreck and to rape, a license that they've filled out and they've issued themselves. I mean, that's the way it works out there. That's number one. Number two out there, the story of wartime disorder may shed light on the draconian efforts of Southern legislators to impose order after the Civil War on the one group that can't fight back. It's the old rule, hit him, he's got no friends. I mean, that's the principle out there. And we're talking black people in the South after the war. I mean, they can't fight back. They don't have the guts to do it. They don't have the protection to do it. They don't have the friends in the community to protect themselves. And if you want to show that you're tough and you're imposing order, that's where you go. Because very quickly you can turn it into such a wonderful narrative. Oh, somebody's found that broke up. Must have been one of their slaves. Ooh, there's a theft of a horse. Must have been a former slave that did it. All that stealing around here, it's those free blacks that do it. And by God, we need black codes on the books to handle it out there. This effort to try to restore hierarchy in terms of race, I think, is connected to this chaos out there. You might call it symptoms of society's emotional trauma, if you want to. The third thing out there is that in wartime violence, we may see one more instigator of the violence post-war, increasingly channeled against white Republicans, increasingly channeled against black Americans, where it's acceptable to use that violence as long as it's directed at those that white society sees as peripheral or sees as expendable. Now that pattern is not just Kentucky's. In fact, it's not, in fact, at its worst in Kentucky, it could be said. You can see it elsewhere. If you go to the so-called Florida parishes, the sort of the eastern edge of Louisiana, there's books about a kind of a violence that spirals out of control and nobody can bring it back in, even after redemption, even after Reconstruction is over. But it really raises to our mind that the costs of war, in this war, as we've seen here in what we've been describing today in your papers, are much higher than we often calculate.
Not just in the field, and not just in the moldering, the swollen, and blackened bodies of the dead in combat, but in terms of emotional and physical trauma and the destruction of property and of lifetime. And it seems to me that it suggests that the Union spokesman at the beginning of the war, the conservative ones, may have really been onto something crucial when they defined what was wrong with secession as seeing as a dangerous step in the breakdown of law, of institutions of order that could only lead to more breakdowns at a smaller and at a lower level until all law became unrespected out there, a threat to conservative values. Now, often, when we see the Civil War, we see it in radical terms, and we think of it in terms of the destruction of slavery, and we think of it as war becomes revolution. And that's the subtitle of one of Alan Nemitz's Ordeal of the Union volumes out there. But the fact of the matter is that for many people, winning this war against the Confederacy is in many ways aimed for the preservation of conservative values, and the crucial conservative values without which a free and liberal society can't possibly survive. This guerrilla warfare may be an illustration of why they were right about that. And of course, it also reminds us of the cynical uses that come with rallying around the flag. If you can wrap almost any kind of cause in the American flag that you want out there, you can wrap your hostility to Sharia law and create parades on it if you want to do that out there. The San Francisco writer and editorialist Ambrose Bierce really has it right when, in the Devil's Dictionary, he says, in Dr. Johnson's famous dictionary, patriotism is defined as the last refuge of a scoundrel. With all due respect to an enlightened but inferior lexicographer, I beg to submit it is